Okay. Gonna open the work session on House Bill 2558. Sandy, review what we're doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. House Bill 2558 had a public hearing on the 14th. As you'll recall, this was requesting and changing statute that the Drug Use Review Board, otherwise known as DUR, provide in reviewing retrospectively and prospective drug use, may only consider drugs that have already received final FDA approval. At that meeting, several of the committee members wanted to hear from the review board. We do have an individual here representing the board and is here to answer and address any of your questions or concerns.
Okay, Kathy? Good morning and thank you for coming.
For the record, my name is Kathy Ketchum. I'm a registered pharmacist in the state of Oregon. I work for the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University. My primary responsibility with the college is to coordinate their activities with OMAP, the Office of Medical Assistance Program. We have an interagency agreement with them to provide a variety of pharmacist consulting services. One of the responsibilities under that contract is to administer and staff the Drug Use Review Board. So I think that is what I'm doing. Did you want history about the DIRT board? Or?
Well, Representative Tome, you had questions. Is there something specific? Or?
Well, yes. As we heard testimony last week, there was testimony that the board had disapproved of drugs that had not yet gone through the Federal Drug Administration. So could you give us the history? I think I understand what your board does, but if you could give us the history of how that decision was reached, that would be really helpful.
Okay. The Drug Use Review Board, as you know, is mandated by federal law, Medicaid law, and it's codified in several rules. Our Oregon statutes actually mirror those rules. One of the responsibilities is to advise OMAP about the therapeutic appropriateness of drugs. They, as part of the prospective drug use review program, the board reviews new drugs as they come to market so that we can establish criteria in the prospective drug use program and establish how the drug should be used. These are generally informational messages given to the pharmacists. In this particular case, which I believe is Zelmar, in September of 2000, the DIRT board reviewed several new drugs, two of which were used for irritable bowel syndrome. They came to our attention because of Motrinox, which is one of the drugs that's used for irritable bowel syndrome, had been released about a year earlier, and there were reports that it was being used inappropriately. It was only approved for women. It was being used in men. And there were some serious side effects associated with this drug and some deaths. So the DIRT board reviewed that drug. As part of that review, we noted that irritable bowel syndrome was below the line, below the coverage line. And we did that at that time in September of 2000, the coverage for that condition was at line 592, and we funded through 574. When we noted that this was a below the line indication and this drug was only used for that, we were aware of another drug coming to market called Zelmar. This drug was not approved yet, but it was an approvable stage at the FDA, which meant that it met all the requirements at the time, and they had a few things that they had to clean up for the reviews. So the DIRT board reviewed that drug as well, noted that both drugs were used only or indicated only for below the line indications, and advised the Department of Human Services to prior authorize that drug for an above the line.
So, again, it's not quite clear to me why you would have made that decision before the FDA had finished.
It had gone through the review of the committee, and it was just sitting there waiting for some special studies to go forward.
The special studies through FDA?
Yeah. They were just final studies. We have to look at drugs.
So if something, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. So if more information had come out from the FDA, is there potential for you to change your recommendation?
Oh, yeah. Yes, and the EHS doesn't act on the recommendation.
Had you ever done this before? Had your board ever done this before?
We had this. I'm not sure that it ever got formalized like this particular one. There was a similar circumstance with the flu drugs that came out.
The flu drugs,
the oral acetaminophen, I can't remember what the other one is called. But below the line, they're used for the treatment of flu. And the treatment of flu is not above the line. Vaccination for the treatment of influenza is not. And so those drugs were also recommended
prior to follow. Thank you. So I just want to make sure that I understand that. It seems to me that there are two issues here. One of them is whether or not the irritable bowel syndrome would be above or below the line, correct? And the other is that disallowing the drug, it's unclear to me, would that have been an issue if IBS had been above the line?
No, it was purely because of the line.
So if it's below the line, and so it wasn't going to be treated anyway, then why was it important to even act on this drug?
Because there's no way for the agency to ensure that they don't pay for below-the-line medication, below-the-line treatments and drugs unless they walk the claim at the pharmacy.
Okay, now I have it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This drug was approved by the FDA, essentially pending some final studies, but it could go out to the market.
Yes. The final resolution is up. Ultramax was removed from the market. It had been the one that was on the market. It was removed from the market because of the side effect issues and re-released about a year later with restricted access. Zelnorm went through an extended, because of the problems with Ultramax, they went through an extended safety review and they were released about a year later.
But these are two totally different chemical drugs.
Yes, they're totally different drugs.
It would seem to me, tell me why, even though it's below the line, there are some patients that certainly could use this drug or might be prescribed this drug, regardless of whether it was below the line or above.
True. Its only indication is for a below-the-line indication. We are only regulating Medicaid prescriptions,
right.
So we weren't restricting in any way the use of this drug in the general population. We were just recommending that the Department of Human Services restrict access because of line placement.
But in so doing, isn't it possible to cast a pall over the usage of this drug for those that were not with Medicaid to be used for Medicaid patients?
The board is only making recommendations for Medicaid, fee-for-service Medicaid.
Has the FDA ever had occasion to have a drug virtually through the process? They're about to release the information and then for reasons pulled it back and started reworking it?
Yes.
Okay. I guess that's kind of the crux of the thing is until they actually release it, there's still question about the fact that they could do that. And so you could be dealing with an entirely different data set.
That's true, and we would re-review it. We perpetually review drugs. The important thing to note is that we have to have criteria in place for our prospective drug use review program at the time the drug hits the market. So we have to review things prior to market in order to be prepared for that.
Well, and I don't think I'm questioning that per se. I'm just questioning the appropriateness of your findings coming out before the federal findings are official.
Again, I would say that we're an advisory board that perpetually reviews. We could update our recommendation if the FDA came out with something new.
Well, for me, it's a matter of appropriateness of process and the timing more than anything else. So do we have any other questions? Representative Anderson.
I'd like to hear the response from Pharma to that.
I bet we can get that.
Before we move on, could I ask a question?
Sure.
If this bill passes, will it restrict what it is that you do?
It will restrict the way the DIR board can operate. Yes, we will not be able to review drugs, new drugs, prior to their market approval.
So once FDA approves a drug, then it's immediately marketable?
Mm-hmm. But sometimes drug companies choose not to market it for several months, but upon FDA approval, they gear up for marketing. We meet quarterly, so we're restricted by that.
So theoretically, then, a drug could be on the market for 3 months before you would have access to.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Pharma. As I testified earlier, we are extremely strong supporters of the DUR process. The 1993 legislation, which codified the DUR process in Oregon, was our bill. So it has remained in its current form since we pushed it through the legislature in 1993. I think the key issue here is a procedural question, but a very important one, and it is this: should the fact that a particular condition-treatment pair falls currently below the line mean that the DIR board can make a preemptive strike and essentially take away the potential that would become treatable and above the line once the new treatment modality, the new drug, becomes available? And those of you who are here heard Dr. Bates speak during the hearing on the bill. He had served as the chair of the commission which actually sets the line, and the treatability of a condition is a key ingredient in determining where the line is drawn. And I'll give you the most dramatic example of that, which is untreatable cancer. That's below the line right now. And by the logic that you just heard, a new treatment that came available, something like the new wonder drug that came out from OHSU, would be preemptively struck because the condition right now is below the line. Now, does that make any sense? No. And the reason is that if the condition becomes treatable by virtue of a new drug, it ought to be able to float up above the line. And that's really the bottom line issue of what this is all about, that we shouldn't preemptively strike down new wonder drugs for a condition that may be below the line simply because they're right now untreatable.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no question regarding the safety of this drug. It's been tested for 5-10 years sometimes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not really the expert on this drug that Mr. Stetcher is, but it is a drug that's gone through extensive review and trials. It's one that has to be very carefully used. It's like some other drugs that have to be extremely carefully monitored. But in fact, it has made a condition that still is below the line more treatable. And that's, I think, the key issue, because treatability is a key criteria for where a condition falls on the line.
And Representative Anderson, the question here isn't a drug. The question here is process. Do you have a follow-up?
But isn't it true, Jim, that some drugs do hit the market even after years and years of testing, and later they're taken off the market because they've been proven to be unsafe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pomeroy, that is precisely correct, and that's the reason that we have the DIR board. one of the reasons that we have it, and that it needs to monitor and evaluate the evolving state of evidence about a particular drug. But it's what they did was the antithesis of that. They struck it down preemptively before it had ever essentially had a chance to be used as a treatment in the market. And it's only after experience accumulates that really the record can be built, even after FDA approval.
So, Jim, if that were the case, and they meet every 3 months, so they could meet in 3 months and look at more evidence and change their decision, couldn't they? And maybe, did they do that in this case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't believe they did. I think this was a deliberate effort to set a policy, a precedent of preemptive strikes. And I would suggest that, in fact, that argument cuts the other way, that there's no reason they couldn't wait 3 months for an FDA-approved drug. They can certainly do analyses in the meantime.
But Jim, somebody theoretically then could be on the drug for 3 months before FDA is approved. It comes out and hasn't gone through DUR. So a doctor has prescribed it, so they're on it for 3 months. Then DUR meets and says, no, it's below the line. Correct? Couldn't that happen?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the question of how we police the line is an entirely different issue, and prior authorization is by no means the exclusive or even preferable way to do that. There was legislation in, for instance, last session, and there's legislation in again this session, which would require a diagnostic code to be placed on every prescription that flows through the Oregon Health Plan system so that it can be edited out at the payment stage by OMAP. That legislation passed both bodies and was vetoed, unfortunately. But that's the preferable way for a condition that is below the line. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we're talking, I think, about how do you edit for conditions that are below the line. And that's the way that at least last session, the legislature chose to deal with that important issue.
If I may follow up.
Yeah.
Jim, I hear you saying FDA goes through, they finish their testing, and it happens in month one. DOR has already met, so they are not going to look at this for 3 more months. In the meantime, the physician will have given this medication out, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's possible.
Theoretically, because it's not had a chance to go through DUR. Then DUR does have a chance to look at this. They decide that it's below the line for a treatment, in this example, with IBS. So I guess to me it makes sense that they would have looked at it before a physician would have had a chance to write a prescription rather than after that. Sometimes up to 3 months after.
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, if what you're trying to do is to make sure that prescriptions are not prescribed for conditions below the line, which is an objective we fully share.
Okay.
The way to do that is not to, in our view, preempt a treatment which may be sufficiently good to bring the condition above the line when the Health Services Commission reprioritizes it, but rather to use a tool like we use to tell whether or not medical services are below or above the line, which is to write the diagnostic code on the prescription, and then the pharmacy edits it out and it doesn't ever get paid. That's the way, in our view, the proper way to make sure we're not paying for things below the line, which is an extremely important objective.
If I could put one last follow-up. Jim, have there been any other drugs this has happened to?
But Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I think there was testimony that the flu drugs were
oh, right.
subject to
okay.
this.
Thank you.
But by this logic, a drug that would be used to treat a condition below the line, like incurable cancer, would fall in that same logic.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Sure. Thank you. Would it not be reasonable that this medication has been out there for quite a while, as it's gone through 5, 10, 15 years of testing, that DUR would not know that it's coming to the market, and that three-month period really would not be of consequence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that's exactly right. There's no reason they couldn't do their studies and do their analyses and get prepped for when it does finally get approved.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Members, from my perspective, this isn't about a drug. This is about a process that, for the most part, works very well, but it seems to me that it's being modified in a way that the process was not intended to be used, and what this bill does is clarify the appropriate process that should be used by DUR. It's relatively simple. Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we move House Bill 2558 to the floor, which will do pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2558 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I'm still troubled by this. It seems to me that we've acknowledged that the Drug Use Review Board has a responsibility to advise the Department of Human Services on the appropriateness of drugs. And we've heard testimony that drugs, they only meet quarterly. So drugs will come out and will be on the market possibly for some time before they have a chance to meet again. And it seems to me that that's their, that the charge that we have given them to review the drugs, that we are hampering them if we require them to wait until it's gotten final approval from the Federal Food and Drug Administration. So I'll be voting against this.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanderson, are you feeling better?
Yes, and you know, I listened to the committee on Monday on the web from home.
How did we sound?
And you guys, you've got to have the microphone right in front. You guys were wonderful, but occasionally someone out there, so make sure that that microphone's right in front of their face. But I enjoyed it listening to you guys. I thought, awesome representatives. Anyway, back to the bill.
Or did you hear me get hazed by the committee?
You always get hazed. So.
Were we talking about audiology at that time?
I am not quite sure really how I will vote. I am going to vote for the bill, but I hear the concerns that are being addressed, and I wish I knew more of the ramifications of this. But my greatest concern is if there is a treatment out there or a drug out there that could make a big difference in a patient's outcome, I would want to not hinder that. So that's fine.
Any other discussion? I guess, keep in mind, committee, we're basically dealing, you know, the drug comes out and it's available on the market, and what we're dealing with here is the Medicaid portion of health care. And I would say with this specific drug, waiting or not wouldn't have made a difference. It's a very specific drug for a very specific condition that is not covered by the Oregon Health Plan. So it wouldn't have been prescribed in Medicaid regardless. Okay, that's not the issue. The issue is to make sure the process works the way it was originally designed to work. Representative Anderson.
But it could be prescribed. It just wouldn't be paid for. Could it not? I mean, if it was a wonder drug and it hadn't...
Well, another drug. I would say in the case of this drug, if somebody had prescribed it for a condition that was covered by the health plan, he might be looking at a malpractice suit. But... Okay, in this particular case. So, and seeing no further discussion, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Excused.
Chair.
Aye. House Bill 2558, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who would like to carry? Representative Anderson will carry. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2558. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2828.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2828 is brought forward. It is, the bill is authorizes a certified nurse practitioner to provide compensable, thank you, medical services that authorize temporary disability benefits and makes findings regarding impairment for workers' compensation claims.
You know, Sandy, I would say we needed to get away from big words, but since you wrote the SMS, it's your own fault.
I know. And I could say it fine yesterday.
Could you? Okay. You need to practice more at night and we'll be fine. Okay. Susan and Tim, please come forward and... Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Good morning.
See, now she knows how to use a mic because you could hear that good, couldn't you? Okay.
Because you've chided me just enough times to get me to do it right. Good morning, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm a registered nurse representing the Oregon Nurses Association today, and with me is Tim Troutman, an adult nurse practitioner from Lincoln City. We are here today to ask for your support of House Bill 2828 to remove a restriction that has existed in state law for about a little over a decade. This restriction came about in the early 1990s during the Mahonia Hall discussions around reforming workers' comp. And at that time, the participants in those discussions were looking for ways to reduce the cost of workers' compensation, the workers' compensation system. And specifically, we're looking at high-cost providers and making an effort to make the costs, reduce the costs. The high-cost providers that the discussion centered on were not primary care providers, in fact, which nurse practitioners are, but were other specialty providers. Unfortunately, nurse practitioners, not being a huge component of the workers' compensation system, had the unfortunate experience of having a 12-visit or 30-day limit put into state law, which means that the current law requires that a nurse practitioner may only treat an injured worker up to 12 visits or 30 days from the date of the injury before needing to get authorization from a medical service provider, in most cases a physician, to continue treatment. I'm not going to dwell on how that affects patients because Tim can speak to you about his patient population. Currently, the most recent data shows that nurse practitioner services equal about 0.1% of the compensable injuries in the state. That data is actually from 2001, but it's the last data available. What we'd like you to consider today are not only the costs that are incurred when this restriction is continued in law, but the delays of care and the impact on the injured worker as well. I'd like to just give you a general overview before asking Tim to talk to you about his specific practice. My colleague nurse practitioners indicate to me that this is a major problem in their practice, no matter where they practice, whether it's in an urban area or a rural area. Let me give you an example. I talked to one of my colleagues a couple of weeks ago who says that when she has an injured worker come to see her, let's just say it's for an ankle injury, those can be tricky. She almost always immediately refers to an orthopedist, which is going to be a higher cost provider than she, because she is never sure whether her treatment would need to extend past the 12 visits or 30 days. And so rather than turn a patient over at the end of that time so that the medical service provider, the physician, can essentially start all over, and perhaps even extend the time that that injured worker needs care, she refers immediately so that she doesn't have to deal with that issue. In her case, she's providing primary care to a group of patients in Tigard. If her patient injured an ankle in the garage lifting boxes, she would be able to authorize time loss to his or her employer. She would be able to continue treatment. However, if the person injures the ankle lifting boxes at work, she is limited in the time and number of visits during which she can provide care to that patient. So we're asking for your support today to remove this restriction and to evaluate whether or not some of the concerns that have been raised in the past, which is if we open more providers to the workers' compensation system, we will incur greatly increased costs. That is an assertion that we reject. Nurse practitioners have shown over the last 25 years that they've been authorized by this legislature to be primary care providers, that they are conservative treaters, they're cost-efficient providers, and for that reason we're asking for your support. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Tim Troutman, adult nurse practitioner in Lincoln City. My practice is a solo practice, and I'm in with there are three other nurse practitioners, and in our clinic we have a combined practice of about three full-time equivalents throughout the work week. I'm in my office 4 days a week. We have a roughly 9,000 open charts in our clinic. I treat roughly a third of those patients. Lincoln City has one physician that I know of that still takes workers' comp claims, and the rest of the physicians refuse. They found it to be time-consuming, paperwork-intensive, and they would just as soon not deal with it. In my practice, I have several patients who are employed by the city of Lincoln City, as well as several contractors. And as you probably are aware, these people are very prone to hurting themselves on the job. It's very physical work. When one of those patients comes to me, who I am usually their treating clinician for the last several years, I have a choice between taking the case and dealing with their problem for 30 days or having them go find somebody to deal with their problem. Now, usually my basic visit is very, very affordable. If I refer them out to an orthopedist, it's going to be 4 to 5 times the amount per visit. It's very frustrating for me as a clinician to be dealing with people in their whole health picture over the course of my practice, and then for them to come in with an on-the-job injury and to have to refer them out. There are usually situations where they will come in with their forms, and we will tell them up front that we will, we can do only so much for them. And so I spend a fair amount of my time on the phone trying to find something from someone who can see them. If I do start the workup, oftentimes that workup is repeated after they've gone to someone else, as the law requires. So.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Davey.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation, and haven't had occasion to appear before this committee this session. Usually these workers' compensation bills end up in a business and labor committee, but happy to be here today to talk about House Bill 2828. And at Safe Corporation, we always have an interest in any bills or proposals that affect the administration of the workers' compensation system, making sure that it's working as well as possible for injured workers and for employers. previous witness spoke correctly about the history of this issue, that you may recall that the first major set of reforms of the workers' comp system took place in 1990 based on management labor agreement. And one of the key things that was decided at that time was that you needed to define an attending physician for workers' compensation purposes, and for that person to act as basically a gatekeeper and be sure that the best, most qualified person was providing appropriate care for injured workers. And that decision, that statute, has basically been unchanged. I think it's been completely unchanged since 1990. Or various providers have proposed bills at various times to have them included in the definition of attending physician, but there have been no changes since 1990. Now, the management labor process continues today. There is an active workers' compensation management labor advisory committee, and they meet regularly during the legislative session. This bill has not yet been presented to them, and they have not had a chance to hear testimony or take a position on this bill. I believe it's on their agenda for a meeting this Friday. In talking to our claims adjusters about their experience with nurse practitioners, I heard a lot of very supportive comments that nurse practitioners are doing a good job for injured workers in a number of ways. The first thing I heard is that they are they tend to spend more time with the patient. They do an initial assessment and a physical exam and a report that is in many cases better than we would get from an MD. They're also very supportive of their patients. On the other side of that issue, what this bill does is to allow nurse practitioners to authorize time loss without limitation, to provide medical services without limitation, and also to rate permanent impairment. Now, my understanding is that the rating of permanent impairment is something that is not usually done by a nurse practitioner. The workers' compensation process requires that when a worker is medically stationary, that their permanent impairment will be evaluated and reported back to the insurer, and then a permanent disability award may be granted based on that impairment rating. The rules for rating permanent impairment are put together by the Workers' Compensation Division. They're based on the AMA's Guide for Evaluation of Impairment. Those rules are over 100 pages long. And physicians right now have developed some expertise in that. The result of those ratings can be awards as high as $100,000 or more. So there is concern about making sure that the appropriate level of expertise is brought to bear in rating impairment. Another issue that came up is that workers' compensation, despite our wishes, tends to be a fairly litigious process. There are thousands of claims that go to litigation every year. We have a fairly technical statute that talks about determining compensability with its interaction with pre-existing conditions and what is the major responsibility cause of a condition and so on. Those are questions that are regularly posed to doctors, and probably doctors are a little more used to dealing with that sort of medico-legal arena than nurse practitioners, who generally work more in a clinical setting. Another issue is the structure of this bill. And as I mentioned, the statute refers to attending physicians. And when I did a quick search of ORS 656, the workers' comp chapter, yesterday, for the words attending physician, there are 64 places in chapter 656 where attending physician is mentioned. And that talks about the responsibilities of attending physicians, even in some areas that the benefits that a worker receives are contingent upon actions taken by an attending physician. Now, what this bill does is to give nurse practitioners some of those responsibilities of an attending physician without actually making them an attending physician. And so I think that the construction of the bill is a little bit clumsy and doesn't take into consideration the fact that there are these 64 places where attending physicians are specifically defined with specific responsibilities within the workers' comp system. It may be that the statute as it exists today is not serving workers well, and we certainly hear about rural crisis of availability of health care. and the committee may want to look at perhaps expanding the time that nurse practitioners can treat in rural areas. Right now they can authorize time loss for 30 days. I'm not sure whether that came out in the previous testimony, but in a rural area, they can authorize time loss for a period of 30 days without referral to an attending physician. Perhaps that would be appropriate to look at that, or maybe also to expand the geographic area in which they practice. That's defined in statute today, and maybe that rural area could move closer to the cities. But I think those are issues that probably will get fleshed out a little bit more before the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And that's all I have to say about that right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And so, Chris, we would know more, have more definition of this issue. This is coming up.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's on the agenda for a meeting on Friday of this week.
So you could get us a report back on what MLAC...
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, DCBS, I think, who manages that committee, would report back to you on what action they've taken.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa. And before you start, for the record, committee, we do have a written testimony from Bradley Witt from AFL-CIO. It was in your packet. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here today to basically ask that you would defer action until the Management Labor Advisory Committee on Workers' Comp has a chance to look at this bill. You've heard a little bit of history about Mahonia Hall. There's a couple of us still in the building that were there in 1990. We've had some, as you might recall, last session there was an extensive bill dealing with workers' comp that passed both houses with management and labor cooperation on. And some of the concerns that we have at this point, Mr. Davies has already indicated, but mainly AOI supports the management labor process for workers' comp. Workers' compensation system in Oregon is one of the few advantages Oregon employers have. So we would just respectfully ask that you allow MLAC to take a look at this proposal before acting on it. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much, Lisa. And we fully intend to do that. That's why it was scheduled just for a public hearing. We're a little loud, aren't we?
Well, he adjusted.
since there's nobody else signed up, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2828, and the committee will stand at ease till we find out what happened to Ms. Oakley.
I want to go ahead and ask.
I guess Carolyn Oakley, who's the regional director for Region 10 of HHS, who is supposed to be here, is ill and is still in Washington State. So the chances of her getting here in the next 10 minutes are probably really slim. So we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.